Welcome to Good For You Radio. I'm Claire Carter, founder of the Good For You Network, which is all about news and information that is good for you to know about, that affects every aspect of your well-being, meaning your health, healing, happiness, prosperity, and peace of mind, and the well-being of our nation and world. Most of us want to be as healthy as we can for as long as we can. I know I do. What can you do today, though, to reduce the chances of developing heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and Alzheimer's in the future? Do you know the one thing that all these diseases have in common? And the answer is inflammation. You may or may not be familiar with a medical test that measures inflammation, and it's possibly the most important test you can take each year. We'll be finding out more about that and what you can do to reduce your inflammation levels. We're going to be talking to a doctor who specializes in integrative medicine, knows only too well the importance of keeping inflammation levels low, and certainly learned that important lesson from his own personal experience with a major illness. He is Dr. Mark Laponis, Corporate Medical Director of Canyon Ranch, one of the leading health resorts and spas in the world, author of Ultra Longevity and the Hunter Farmer Diet Solution, and co-author of Ultra Prevention. Mark, welcome to Good For You Radio.
Thanks, Claire. It's good to be here.
Well, I love that word, you know, prevention. And I try and do what I can to prevent. I mean, you can't do everything. But I remember years ago when I read a book called The Wisdom of Healing by Dr. David Simon, who was working with Dr. Deepak Chopra and the Chopra Center for Well-Being that they developed together. And the thing that I never forgot was how he said all he wanted to do when he went to medical school was learn, how do I keep my patients healthy and well? But it seemed like all he was learning was sickness and disease and illness, which is certainly something you have to learn. But he said, if your only tool is a hammer, then everything is going to look like a nail to you. So that was what made me wonder about your own experience in medical school. Was it a similar experience to Dr. Simon?
I think it's similar for all doctors, and that is they focus on diseases because there's so many to learn, and you know, you have to be able to recognize each one, and there's only 4 years in medical school, so they just don't have time, unfortunately, to teach doctors how to keep people healthy as opposed to just diagnosing their illness.
So when you started out your medical practice, your first private practice, did you feel, oh my gosh, I've got the tools that I need, or oh, I need to learn more?
Well, no, nobody has the tools. You sort of start off, knowing what you know, and then you build from there. And there's so much, let's say, on-the-job training that has to happen. There's a lot of things that you learn after you've started your practice, and that builds up over time as experience. Now, I've been at it for 30 years, so I've accumulated a fair amount of experience. It's helpful.
Go back to that earlier learning experience. What were some of the lessons you had to learn that you'll still remember? Oh, my gosh, I can't believe I did that.
Well, there's a million of them. It's pretty scary, but, you know, in the past, I've read through notes that I had written perhaps 10 years ago, and I say, my goodness, did I really write that? You know, silly things like I would tell patients, you know, you can't really lower cholesterol much with diet. It's mostly genetic, and it's produced by the liver, and so you can only affect those about 20% with diet. Of course, in those days, I didn't know how to lower cholesterol with diet. Now that I've learned, I don't say things like that anymore.
What got you to finally decide, I need to open up my own experience, my own toolbox, and got you gravitating towards, I want to know about integrative medicine, complementary, alternative therapies, this, that, diet, exercise, all the other stuff?
Well, you know, I realized that the amount that I could do for my patients in a half an hour office visit was pretty limited. And the most important thing was teaching them how to live a healthier life. In other words, how they should eat. Should they lose weight? How's their salt intake? Have they, you know, had enough fluid during the day? Have they, you know, been exercising? Are they as fit as they should be? Do they get enough rest at night? How is stress affecting their health? And once I learned how to help people to understand how to live a healthier lifestyle, you know, we started getting better results, more prevention and better health outcomes.
Well, would you have said when you were in your, right after medical school, in your 20s, your mid-30s, whatever, you're 35 years old, would you have said you're a healthy, well person? How would you have rated yourself in terms of taking good care of you?
Well, I'd say, you know, coming right out of my training, I would have thought, you know, pretty healthy, you know, maybe under a little bit of stress because of starting a young family. And my wife is a physician also. We were, you know, had busy schedules. So I would have perhaps recognized that I was not as healthy as I could be, not getting enough sleep, being under quite a bit more stress, maybe working too long hours. But, you know, physically, I actually felt okay.
And then one day you had a symptom, the kind of symptom that you go to your doctor about and say, what's going on here? Tell us about that.
Well, I did. I was working in the emergency room one evening, and it was a busy shift. I remember I barely had time to write my notes, and I had to wait to urinate, and I went to go to the bathroom finally. And when I urinated, I had blood in my urine. It was like, well, you know, red Kool-Aid. And I knew right away that something was wrong. At the time, I was sort of, I guess, wishfully thinking that it was something simple, like maybe a stone or an infection, something like that. But then when I went the next day to get it looked at, they found a tumor in my kidney, and it turned out to be kidney cancer. I was only 36 years old at the time, so...
What was your reaction? 36 is so young.
That's not on your radar screen when you're 36. Yeah. I don't care who it is. I don't think anybody's thinking that, my goodness, I wonder if I have cancer. It always comes as a shock and a surprise, of course. And in my case, you know, even being a physician, I was as shocked, scared, and surprised as anyone would be. And, you know, at 36, I had young children. They were 2, 3, and 5 mm-hmm. years old at the time. And I was just, you know, wondering if I was going to get to see them graduate from high school or, you know, get married or have children of their own. I mean, those are the immediate thoughts when you're diagnosed.
You had some interesting questions that you asked yourself when you wrote about this in the book Ultra Prevention. You wanted to know how someone, quote, as informed as you could have developed such a deadly condition.
Well, I thought I was doing things right. In other words, I, you know, had my doctor's hat on, and I thought that I was doing things properly and didn't have any symptoms and mm-hmm. had not looked specifically for that problem because I wasn't aware of it. And so for me, you know, I was operating under, you know, normal operating procedure, and that is, you know, doing my usual thing. And let me tell you, when you have a diagnosis like that, it makes you, you know, take a hard look at the things you're doing and what you might do differently.
Well, you said you didn't have any symptoms, so you also questioned something like, how long was this going on in your body? How long was it percolating before you manifested that one symptom? What kind of answer did you come up with?
Well, that was something I wanted to know, and that was, when did this cancer start? Because I knew when it was diagnosed, but how long had it been going before it was diagnosed? And, you know, I asked my colleagues, I asked the pathologist looking at my, you know, kidney under the microscope, I talked to my cancer doctors about it, and they all gave pretty much the same answer, and that is something of this size has to have been there for at least 10 years. And that shocked me because, you know, at 36, you know, I was thinking at least since I was mid-20s that had been growing. And that's, you know, that's a real eye-opener.
If you, the doctor of today, were to talk to that younger self of yours, what do you wish you had known then when you were in medical school or whatever that might have helped you with this, maybe to have gotten it earlier before it manifested that one serious symptom?
You know, I don't know. It'd be great if there was something simple that we could all ask ourselves to know that it's time to get a checkup. But, I mean, think about it. When you were 36, were you thinking about visiting the doctor? Did you think about going in for a checkup? Did you think about getting, you know, a blood test or a urine sample? I mean, that's not on the radar screen for most 36-year-olds. You know, they're more worried about, you know, their family and, you know, putting food on the table. So, you know, even as a doctor, unfortunately, it hadn't really got my attention. So the first symptom was a real wake-up call.
I think also, you know, you're 20-something or 30-something, and maybe you're feeling like you're immortal, you're going to live forever, and not thinking that you're susceptible. So I wondered when I began talking to you about inflammation being a major symptom of all these diseases, if you had known more about inflammation, would that have made a difference?
Well, back in those days, you know, of course, we're talking now about 20, 21 years ago, mm-hmm. and we didn't know that much about inflammation, and we knew that there were some ways that you could measure it, but we didn't understand the importance of it. We didn't understand that it was really an underpinning to the chronic diseases and these conditions that we see very commonly. In other words, it may be an early sign or even an early trigger for a lot of these conditions, and thankfully, the testing around this has improved to the point where now we do have very accurate, very important and helpful tests to check for inflammation. And that's important in giving people a heads up. In other words, now we know who we should be concerned about and maybe investigate further when they're showing these signs of inflammation.
So you want your patients to take something called a C-reactive protein test. Explain it, how it measures inflammation.
Well, you know, if you think of inflammation as, let's say, a stress response of the immune system, you know, our immune system is our defense system. It's there to help protect us from the things that might, you know, affect us during our lives. And, you know, over the course of human lives, the most important ones are things like infections. You know, so often we get, you know, it might start with a strep throat or turn into pneumonia, or we might get a kidney infection. And it's so important that our immune system is able to conquer these infections that occur so commonly. And so inflammation is one of the ways that our immune system fights these infections. And what we've learned is the immune system responds with inflammation to any stress, to any threat. That could be an infection, but it might also be cancer. But it could also be something like emotional stress, or perhaps lack of sleep, or not being fit, or gaining weight. Those are all sort of precursors of the conditions and illnesses that we see later. And so, that gives us an opportunity to make changes.
So if you take a C-reactive protein test and for some reason your levels are high, then this is the puzzle that has to be solved. Like, what is causing it? It could be a lot of different things before you get really scared that it's something like cancer.
Yeah, I mean, cancer isn't the first thing that you think of. If somebody has signs of inflammation, the first thought is maybe there's an infection, for example. So that's the first thing to rule out or in, and let's make sure there's no infection present. And in my case, if I had tested 21 years ago for the signs of inflammation, we would have found them, because my immune system was trying to fight this cancer, but I wasn't aware of it. But the markers would have been positive.
I remember one day watching Dr. Oz, and he gave the C-reactive protein test to his whole audience. And a good percentage of his audience were very high. They had high inflammation. Yeah. So they were walking around just not knowing. I mean, thank goodness he did the test. And at least now they have that to take to their doctor. But how long has this test been around?
Well, the test became much more accurate about 15 years ago. There's a doctor in Boston, Dr. Ritker, who actually improved on the existing C-reactive protein test. And in the past, it used to tell us if your level was about 5 or less. Now, the test can tell us if the level is as low as 0.05. In other words, it's about 100 times as accurate. And that is when we really started learning that the level of inflammation that's involved with diseases like cancer, heart attack, stroke, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, it's much lower than the levels we had been able to measure in the past. And so it was really about 15 years ago, and it was right around 2000, when we started to be able to measure these very low but important levels of inflammation. And that's when the information and the research started to blossom about the value of measuring the level of inflammation.
From the point that I learned about the test, I've told so many people about it, and so many people have not known about the test, or it hasn't been a regular part of their blood work, and I'm wondering how true that is today.
It's probably about 50-50. I think the doctors that are more focused on prevention are very interested in knowing what someone's C-reactive protein level is. If somebody's out of shape, overweight, dealing with diabetes, has had a stent placed, they know that they have bad, you know, fat and cholesterol, it's no surprise that their inflammation level might be up. The value is really when you're testing people who aren't sick, that don't have symptoms. And let's say, for example, with me, I really felt okay. But if somebody had found that I had a high level of inflammation and they had done the test to find out why, we might have been able to find the problem sooner.
So if you want to prevent or get to something before it travels like a cancer from stage 1 to stage 2 to 3 to 4, then you really want to have a C-reactive protein test on a regular basis, correct?
Well, it's something that gives you a heads up. Like, for example, if somebody, you know, had some unusual symptoms, or let's say that they had a pain or they had fatigue or they didn't feel sharp, and we found that the C-reactive protein, the level of inflammation, was high, then we would want to investigate why. And the things that we found are, you know, they could be all over the map. For example, it might be Lyme disease. That's not unusual. Someone has picked up a chronic infection with Lyme disease that's raising the level of inflammation. And that's so very important because we have treatment for that.
But you know, it's interesting when you say Lyme disease. Somebody I know was talking to a couple of weeks ago, and she'd been at the emergency room at the hospital, and she was experiencing all this, numbness all the way up her legs and to her chest, and they could not figure it out. And after all of the testing, they said the good news is, and it isn't A, B, C, D, E, F, we have no idea what it is. And so it took 2 weeks before she got to a specialist because I said, you've got to find somebody who's a great diagnostician. And I just learned today, it's Lyme disease.
See.
And they didn't know at the hospital. I mean, that's a hard disease to sometimes figure out.
It is. And the C-reactive protein is so helpful because, of course, if somebody has a chronic infection like Lyme disease, they're not just feeling symptoms and everything looks fine. They're feeling symptoms and their blood is showing signs of inflammation. That's usually the tip-off.
When you had your own personal experience, how did it change not only the way you practice medicine, but your life, your lifestyle? Was it a life?
Well, I left the practice of medicine, actually. Not exactly, but I left my practice.
Yeah.
And I came to Canyon Ranch, where the focus is really on health and wellness and prevention. And that was 21 years ago. And it was a good decision because it was really helpful for reducing my own stress, first of all. And also,
doctor, heal thyself.
That's true. You know, and helping me to live a better life, to eat better, to be more fit, to exercise on a more regular basis, to learn the importance of stress reduction and to get better sleep, et cetera.
Okay, let's talk about inflammation. We're going to focus right now. What do you consider normal? What does the test tell you is normal versus where you like patients to be?
Sure. I mean, the lab, when you run the test, will give you what the ranges are for the C-reactive protein test. And by the way, the one that we're interested in is called the highly sensitive C-reactive protein. It's sometimes called the cardio C-reactive protein because it's been linked with heart attacks. But there's nothing about it that's specific for the heart. But it is highly sensitive. And with the highly sensitive readings, the target should be less than 1. People want their levels to be below a level of 1. If the level is between 1 and 3, we know that that's a person who's at increased risk for heart attack, stroke, cancer, and diabetes. And over 3, the risk is exceedingly high. And that's where we really need to get the level down, especially when someone's after the age of 50.
So if something runs in your family, it's part of your family history, and you can somehow manage to keep your inflammation levels lower, you are less likely to get whatever that disease is?
Yes, true. For example, we know that controlling levels of inflammation can help to stave off things like diabetes. It can help to protect against a heart attack, a stroke. I mean, these are conditions that are always catastrophes, and they're always a surprise. Nobody wakes up in the morning saying, boy, I think I might have a stroke today. You know, it always comes as a surprise. But the way to know if we should be concerned is with the C-reactive protein test. And if your level is less than 1, you should feel safe. If your level is over 3, we need some answers.
But you, as you said, only 50% of doctors are doing the test. So what's with the other doctors? Why haven't they got on board the C-reactive protein train?
Well, part of the problem with the test is that it's not specific for any condition. In other words, a high C-reactive protein doesn't mean diabetes or heart attack. It means it could be one or the other or both or maybe some other things too. So that's a sort of scary world for doctors to operate in. They don't want to operate in the world where there's something brewing, but we don't know what it is. On the other hand, if we did know that someone had high levels of inflammation, I've learned that there are several things that that person could do to help prevent a problem from occurring. For example, they could be doing more exercise. They could be changing their diet. They could be losing a few pounds. They could be trying to get better sleep at night. They could be taking some anti-inflammatory supplements, perhaps. They might consider taking a baby aspirin to prevent against heart attack and stroke. They might consider an omega-3 fish oil, which has been shown to lower the levels of inflammation. And those are just a few of the things. There are so many options and opportunities we have to help lower our levels of inflammation that I really think it's important for everyone to know what their levels are.
That's a lot. You've given us a big mouthful to digest now. So let us go one by one in terms of diet. What are the foods that are inflammatory that you should pretty much cut down on or avoid, especially if inflammation levels are high?
Yeah, when it comes to foods, you know, the first thing for me is just thinking about the portions, because too much food will raise the level of inflammation.
And why is that?
Well, partly because when we eat a lot of food, our body processes the food to turn it into energy. And one of the byproducts are these so-called free radicals that are produced, and they're related to how many calories we eat. In other words, the more calories we eat, the more free radicals we'll produce, and they're very inflammatory. So what we found is the levels of inflammation that we can measure will go up even after a big meal.
Even after a healthy meal, even if after I'm eating all the good fruits and veggies and all of that?
If it's too much, yes. And so what we try to do first is get people to be eating the right amount of food. That's the most important thing. That's the first step.
So smaller portions are better?
Sure. Smaller portions are better and less food in general. And, you know, one easy way to know is if your weight is okay. You know, if you're struggling with your weight and always trying to lose, then we need to make an adjustment on the quantity of the food. That's the first thing. Now, the quality, of course, is also very important because we've learned that the more processed foods, the more refined foods, the more sweetened foods, the fattier foods are foods that will raise the inflammation level. The foods that are lower in sugar, lower in fat, higher in fiber, and unprocessed foods help to lower the level of inflammation. So, for example, instead of, let's say, plain pasta, somebody might choose whole grain pasta. Instead of white bread, a whole grain, whole wheat, or, you know, sprouted, or, you know, seven grain bread would be a better choice.
Yeah, let's talk about the sprouted, because I discovered sprouted whole grain, and I either do, like, there's a one company, Veganix, that makes this sesame seed spelt bread that's really good.
How does it taste?
Tastes delicious. And the Ezekiel...
You mean good food doesn't have to taste bad?
Yeah. No, Ezekiel makes these English muffins. I make little English muffin pizzas. No, it doesn't. But this was the interesting thing that I found. It's rich in vital nutrients and all of that, but I found I could eat it and not gain weight from the sprouted whole grain. If I were to eat regular bread in the same quantity, I feel like I'd gain a pound.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's because the fiber content of those breads actually help us to maintain our weight. And so it's a good choice. You know, one tip that I always give people is when you're buying bread, something like bread, check the nutrition facts label. And what you want to see is that there's a higher fiber content than sugar content. So if the fiber number outweighs the sugar number, it's probably a good choice in buying bread. Unfortunately, most of the white bread that you'll find in the grocery store doesn't meet that little, you know, requirement. So take a look at the nutrition facts next time you buy bread and you'll be able to buy a better loaf.
Well, I was raised without the white pasty stuff because my mother believed in the whole grains, but you know, I wanted the white pasty stuff as a child. Today, my taste buds have changed. Unless I'm in a restaurant that is serving the most fabulous home-baked bread, then of course I'm going to eat it. You know, but at home, I actually like the sprouted whole grains once I got introduced to it. I think part of it is getting used to it, and it's also there are people who grow up and they only know the white pasty stuff. And so, but you have to be open to getting introduced. So we're talking about foods. Okay, the bread. What about the egg yolk? I mean, eggs can be healthy, but what about the egg yolk? Is that inflammatory?
Well, you know, the egg yolk has gotten a bad rap, you know, over the years because of the focus on cholesterol for so long and knowing that eggs do contain some cholesterol, the advice has come out that people, you know, initially were supposed to avoid egg yolks, and that's where all these egg white omelets have really, you know, become so popular. But, you know, more recently when it's been studied with more detail, they found that the egg yolk actually is not a problem in terms of raising cholesterol, and it turns out there's some very important nutrients that are found in the egg yolk that might be hard to find in other places. Things like choline, which is really important for the brain. And so if somebody wants to have a couple of eggs a day and include the yolk, it really has a negligible effect on their cholesterol, and it might have an important effect on their brain. And so, you know, eggs are good these days. I mean, it's back to being, you know, kind of a health food. So I prefer, of course, the natural free-range or organic eggs that are higher in omega-3s, and they don't come with, you know, antibiotics and things.
And hormones.
I think it's a better kind of egg if you look for that kind of egg. But a couple of those a day should be a health benefit, not a health risk.
So you mentioned choline. Tell us about choline and why it's not so good for the brain.
Well, we know the brain, takes a lot of impact of the aging process, and unfortunately, the brain is susceptible to damage from our environment and the way that we live. It's why we're seeing an increasing, incidence of things like Alzheimer's disease and people that are dealing with premature memory loss. And even though we still don't understand what's causing a lot of this, we know that lifestyle is a big factor. People that are overweight, don't exercise, aren't fit, But diet is also important, and that is we know that choline is an important source of nutrients for the brain. It makes acetylcholine, which is one of the brain neurotransmitters from choline. And having a supply of choline is essential for healthy brain function, and one of the best places to get that from is actually eggs. So I encourage people, if they like them, to go ahead and include the yolk with the egg when they have it, not just the white.
Right. But also the omega-3 fats. So let's talk about that and why that's good. I mean, not only for your brain, but for other parts of your body.
Well, omega-3 fats are the ones that are found primarily in fish in the animal world. And in the plant kingdom, it's found in things like flax seeds and chia seeds. It's found in things like kale and walnuts. And what we think is important is that the omega-3 fats have an anti-inflammatory effect, whereas some of the animal fats, not the omega-3 animal fats, but let's say the saturated animal fats, may cause more inflammation. And it's important to get a balance. In other words, to have some of the omega-3s, not all just the saturated animal fats that you get from things like, you know, beef or from even poultry. And that means people need to be eating some fish. The best approach is to try to make sure that we're getting fish at least twice a week.
What kind of fish? Because there's the big fish that has the mercury, like tuna.
The choice of fish is important, and we'd like to choose the healthiest fish. And generally speaking, there are some kind of simple rules of thumb. One is to try to get fish that are lower on the food chain. You know, by the time you get to be a tuna fish, you're right, you've got a lot of contaminants, the mercury and PCBs because of...
And I'm so sorry because I loved tuna fish as a kid. Give me a tuna fish sandwich. That was like the best thing you could do. But
sure.
It does have mercury.
Not just mercury, but again, some of these fat-soluble pollutants like pesticides and PCBs are found in the tuna. And it's only because the tuna are so big and they've lived so long and they've eaten so many little fish that those contaminants accumulate in the tuna.
So that's good for the tuna, but it's not good for us when we consume the tuna.
Sure, because now we're actually even higher on the food chain than the tuna when we eat the tuna. And so it's better to go lower on the food chain. So things like, you know, mackerel, sardines, herring, you know, salmon, char, these are better choices because those fish haven't been alive so long and haven't contaminated themselves as well.
What about if you're not a big fish person? I mean, is taking supplements, whether it's fish oil, there's something called sea buckthorn, there are other essential fatty acids that could be helpful?
Well, it raises a good point, and I get this question all the time, and people ask me, you know, should I take a fish oil supplement? And my first question to them is, well, do you eat fish? Because if somebody's eating fish five times a week, they generally don't need a supplement of fish oil. On the other hand, if somebody, like you mentioned, says, no, I really don't eat enough fish, that's where we really should consider a fish oil supplement, and especially if someone eats no fish, because it's impossible to get enough of the fish omega-3s if you don't eat fish in your diet.
You know, I remember years ago talking to a nutritionist who said to me, well, not a believer in vitamins and minerals and supplements, you can get everything from your diet. And I'm thinking, what diet are you eating, or what diet are most people eating? Because, I mean, I know 6 to 8 servings, you know, a day of fruits and veggies, and I eat relatively healthy. But sometimes I can't do 6 to 8 servings, and I'm thinking, I can't get everything from my diet.
It's so true, and that is, you know, it's a rare person that eats well enough that they can get all the nutrients that they need every day from their diet. In fact, it's thought that 90% of Americans don't get the nutrients that they need in their diet every day.
90%, that's a very high number.
Yeah, that's 90%, and that means only 10% of us are getting enough of the nutrients that we need. Part of the problem is also compounded by that issue that we were talking about, quantity. You know, when we eat a lot of food, but it's not dense in nutrients, that can deplete the levels of nutrients and vitamins that we have because the vitamins are used to combat the free radicals that are produced from the overeating. And so when somebody is overweight or carrying extra weight, they have actually depleted themselves in the nutrients and vitamins that their body...
Explain once again how these free radicals get created by the oxidative stress, by all this food that goes into us?
Well, sure. It happens in turning food into energy. And the way that occurs, we make something called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It's the storable form of energy that every cell in our body runs on.
That's a mouthful, that term.
Yeah,
one more time.
We just use ATP.
Okay.
ATP, that's the body's fuel. It's like the gasoline for the car.
Okay.
That's what makes us run.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ATP is produced from food, but in producing the ATP, we generate these free radicals in proportion to the calories that we've consumed. Now, normally, our body knows how to handle the free radicals. We have an antioxidant system that our body produces natural antioxidants that will snuff out all those free radicals. The problem is if we're overeating, our body doesn't have enough of those antioxidants to do what it needs to do, and now we're subjected to the inflammation that results from this free radical stress.
Again, another cause of inflammation. So, if you're friendly to supplements of sorts, which ones are the antioxidants that you can then take, whether it's as a whole food or a synthetic?
Well, in terms of food, the antioxidants are found mostly in the fruits and vegetables, and the ones that are really good are the colorful ones. So when you see brightly colored berries, raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, when you see brightly colored, you know, foods like sweet potatoes and squashes, that's got a lot of beta-carotene. Well, beta-carotene can snuff out 20 free radicals. It's very powerful. And so what we've learned is by just looking at the color of foods, we can predict how well they're going to help us to combat free radicals. My idea is always to eat by color as opposed to by preference, and that is when I go to the salad bar, I get green, then I get red, then I get yellow, orange, blue, purple, brown. I look down, and it should look like a Monet, and now I know I'm getting all of the necessary antioxidants. Same thing in the shopping center. You go to the grocery store, and you want to buy something green, something orange, something yellow, something red, something blue, something purple, something brown. Get all of those colors in the basket, and then you know you're really getting the free radicals attended to.
You have a plate that is a beautiful rainbow. Some people don't. Their plate doesn't look like a rainbow.
Well, sure. If it's white and brown, we have a problem.
I mean, is it okay to say, look, I haven't gotten my fruits and veggies today, but I'm going to take a supplement, at least get me some antioxidants in my body that way?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of situations in which that's something worth considering. For example, if someone's overeating and it's junk food, they should be taking a supplement because they're not getting the antioxidants that they should be getting in the food. So if somebody's going out and all they're having is pasta dinners and fast food and lots of, you know, burgers at fast food drive-thrus, well, they're not getting much in the way of color in that diet, meaning their food doesn't have enough antioxidants. That's somebody who might consider, you know, supplementing, but also changing their diet, you know, to get more of the colors in. And they're also getting so many calories, perhaps, that they do need extra antioxidant support. The other category would be somebody, perhaps, that is just a picky eater. You know, if somebody is just, you know, they're on the white bread and white pasta and crackers diet, the one that, you know, our kids used to like when they were 5 years old,
mm-hmm.
That diet, which is devoid of color and antioxidants, that's a person that might consider a supplement or changing the diet. Again, now there's some things that are simple to add to the diet. For example, more fruits and vegetables and berries. I mean, adding more blueberries, more raspberries, throwing in some, you know, colorful fruits and vegetables. That's a great way to get more antioxidants.
And I add mine to low-fat Greek yogurt, and I add chocolate whey protein powder to it, and flaxseed. You're big on fiber. You really believe fiber. Explain the relationship between fiber and inflammation.
Well, the nice thing about fiber, and we're talking about the kind of fiber that's found in food, not the kind of fiber that you would buy, you know, at the pharmacy. The fiber found in food contains both essential forms of fiber, and those are soluble and insoluble fiber. And the higher our dietary fiber intake is, the lower our level of inflammation. So it's one of the best ways to combat inflammation.
And fiber, you like, I know, beans. That's the big thing for fiber? Is that
beans is probably the best food for fiber, and that's because something like, let's say, black beans. If you had a cup of black beans, that's almost 14 grams of fiber right there. That's half of your daily requirement for fiber just in a cup of black beans. And, you know, I love things like a bowl of lentil soup because a bowl of lentil soup has 12 or 13 grams of dietary fiber.
Lentil soup is good, but Mark, a cup of black beans, I don't know how many people are going to sit there and eat a whole cup of black beans. I'm sorry.
Well, start with a half a cup, and then later on you might get some edamame beans or have a little hummus, or maybe you would have, you know, some of the, you know, a little chili later in the day. Those are some other great ways to get get more beans.
I want to make a deal with you. I happen to like baked beans, but I know that baked beans have molasses. I could do a cup of baked beans. That's the one kind of bean that I could actually do and love. I buy Eden's organic baked beans when I just feel like baked beans.
And okay, good.
I know it has a little molasses in it, but...
Well, there's a little sugar, but look, at least you're getting the fiber, right?
Well, yeah. And what about, I mean, I add to my Greek yogurt in the morning flaxseed fiber.
Great way to get fiber, flax seeds or the flaxseed fiber, any of the bran. You know, if you want to add oat bran to the yogurt, that's another great way to get fiber. The berries, like you say, throw the blueberries in there. The raspberries, an excellent way to get fiber.
I do the strawberries. And the thing is, I add a whey protein powder that's chocolate because cocoa is good for you, right?
Well, cocoa has antioxidant properties because of the color. In other words, think of the dark, rich, you know, brown color of cocoa. It's very rich in antioxidants.
So I make my breakfast or brunch taste like dessert because the whey protein powder in the chocolate flavor somehow mixes, you know, and I mix it with almond milk and it makes like a vanilla fudge to the yogurt. And then you add the fruit and I feel like I'm eating this dessert, but it does have protein and fiber in it. But it tastes good because I don't think most people want to eat things if it tastes like medicine.
True, and we know it's working for you because you have one of the lowest inflammation levels we've measured, Claire.
Well, I've learned from you over the years, and I've known Mark for years. What I also wanted to know is you talk about exercise. How much exercise is going to make a real difference in terms of people's inflammation levels?
It doesn't take that much. You know, I think people have this idea that if they're going to start an exercise program, they got to spend, you know, 2 hours in the gym and, you know, come out wrung out like a wet dish rag. But no, it only takes about, let's say, 30 minutes, 5 days a week of aerobic exercise to lower the C-reactive protein level.
And by aerobic exercise, what kind of exercise?
Well, that might be like a light jog, or it might be riding a bike, for example, or maybe you would do a fast walk, or it could be going in the pool and swimming, you know, for a while, or it might be, you know, a dance class. I mean, that's one of my favorite ways to do it because, you know, when you go to a dance class, you're moving and you're having fun and you're socializing and it's breaking a sweat and getting your heart rate up and smiling at the same time. So I love that.
I love the idea of smiling. I mean, you were talking about stress. Smiling is good for you.
Sure. We know that stress is one of the factors that can stress our immune system and therefore raise the C-reactive protein. So people that are anxious, people that are angry, people that are sad, those all tend to raise the C-reactive protein. And so, you know, dancing and smiling can help combat those.
Yeah. But as a doctor, when you sit with people, unless you get them to really be honest with you, I've always felt you can tell people, oh, everything is fine or whatever, but when you go home at night, you've got to be honest with yourself. So how do you as a doctor draw people out? Because a lot of people don't spend very much time with their doctors anymore.
There's the key right there, and that is the time. You know, I'm very fortunate to be at Canyon Ranch because that's one of the values of being here is I get enough time to spend with people to understand the story. Like we said, it's like putting the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle together. If you just have one piece, you can't see the picture. You have to have enough time to put those puzzle pieces together to understand the big picture of someone's health. And, you know, that's so essential. We all want somebody who can understand the big picture of our health and help be the quarterback of our health so that we can be, let's say, the CEO and do the right thing.
Well, that's the whole idea with the Good For You Network. It's about be the CEO of your own well-being, take charge of your own well-being and how you can do it. And I've always loved that expression because who's on your team, your doctor, your dentist, your, you know, who's going to join the team and whatever, Team Laponis, Team Carter. But you need a team of people that you can rely on. And then, but you, in the end, have to take charge of your well-being. I think about somebody who recently said to me, he was just diagnosed with diabetes, and I said, gee, did you have any idea? And he said, 2 years ago, his doctor said he's pre-diabetic. He needs to change how he's eating. And he just couldn't give up his junk food. And then he was diagnosed with diabetes. And now he's had to. He's lost weight. But I thought, what a shame to have to get the disease to get you to finally change your diet. He got the warning. A lot of people don't get a warning. And you look at, there was a recent study that said close to half of Americans are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. And I went, can that be right?
Yeah, I mean, it's staggering how much diabetes we're seeing and how much obesity-driven diabetes. And of course, the rates of obesity have been climbing steadily for the last several decades. It's finally seeming to perhaps level off. We might be finally starting to stem the tide of obesity, but until we do, you're right, we're going to see up to half of Americans being diagnosed with diabetes.
And that is another disease of inflammation. So if you have the inflammation from diabetes, does that also make you more vulnerable to some other diseases?
That's right. And that is, if somebody's becoming diabetic, guess what? They're also prone to a heart attack. They're also prone to a stroke. They're also more prone to cancer. And so those are the concerns.
And it's interesting, even your age doesn't protect you, because every now and then, you know, you hear about somebody who's really young and that happens too.
I know the feeling. At 36, diagnosed with cancer myself. So you're right. You know, in fact, I just saw the first report on the news just this week of it was a toddler that was being treated for adult diabetes. And I'm thinking, my goodness, what kind of a world has occurred where we have toddlers now being diagnosed with adult onset diabetes?
Have you ever heard of that before?
It just shocked me. It shocked me.
I mean, how can that be?
It was an obese little toddler that was eating poorly.
Well, but doesn't it also start from the time a mother is pregnant in terms of good health and well-being and what you're going to be transmitting while the child is a fetus and then coming out into the world?
Thank you for saying that. You know, maternal nutrition during pregnancy is so essential, and people don't realize it's not just while you're pregnant, it's also preparing for the pregnancy. So you really need to maintain a healthy diet before you even think about getting pregnant. It's very important.
I've always said, Mark, you can do everything right, and it doesn't mean you don't get sick. I mean, let's face it, that can happen. But if you do everything wrong, you're just increasing your chances. And I thought about that when I mentioned earlier Dr. David Simon. I did not know until I just went and checked, because I had met him years ago. He died not that long ago, and it was a brain cancer, glioblastoma, the same disease that got Senator Ted Kennedy. And I thought, here was a man who, wonderful man, I really enjoyed meeting him. He was at the forefront of mind-body medicine. He was meditating. He was doing all the healthy things. It doesn't make you necessarily immune.
No. I mean, there's no guarantees, of course. And the idea is that we'd like to delay anything as long as we possibly can and maintain, you know, the full function so that we're able to fully engage with life. And then at the end, we'd like to, you know, go quickly when our time comes. We don't want to linger and suffer. And we've learned that the best way to, let's say, compress the morbidity toward the end of life is by living a healthy lifestyle.
Well, you know, I remember reading Lorraine Bracco, the actress, had decided she was going to write a book. But first, she decided she was going to change her lifestyle because she was taking care of her parents toward the end of their life, and they both were taking so many different medications. And when she saw the number, the sheer number of medications, she said to herself, wake up call. I don't want to end up my life taking that kind of quantity of medications. It got her to go on a diet, change her lifestyle. So everybody can have their own wake up call. You can't force somebody to do it. It's got to come from you where you say, this is worth it.
Well, good for her for, you know, listening to the wake-up call, but also shame on her doctors, her mother's doctors, for prescribing all those medicines. You know, we should be trying to get people off of medicines, not prescribing more. I mean, it's our duty to also figure out which medicines could be stopped. And well, that's so important, because medicines are just continued. You know, so many people end up on so many medicines that the pharmacy can't even figure out, you know, if they're interacting or not. And, you know, that's a real problem. You know, one of the things that I spend a lot of time on is there something that someone could do to get off of their medicines? Like, let's say their blood pressure. Maybe they could be eating different, cutting down on their salt intake. Maybe they could drop 10 pounds. Maybe they could start to go to the gym. Maybe they could take CoQ10.
Talk about coenzyme Q10, because that's an important antioxidant. What that does for the body.
Well, CoQ10, which is made by the body, it's one of the natural antioxidants in the body, but it's also available as a supplement. And we know it's one of the most helpful supplements when it comes to cardiovascular disease, because it can help lower blood pressure, and it can help stabilize arrhythmias, and it can help the health of the heart in general, and it can counteract some of the side effects from the medications that might lower cholesterol, like the statin medications. And so we feel that CoQ10 is an important addition for people that are dealing with those issues.
I remember once I was at a wedding and I was talking to a cardiologist, and she said to me, well, don't badmouth my statin drugs. But I said, but do you tell your patients, I mean, if they need it, they need it, but do you tell your patients that it might deplete their coenzyme Q10 levels and minerals like magnesium, potassium? And she said, no. And I said, why not? She said, well, CoQ10 is expensive. And I said, suffering severe muscle fatigue that possibly could kill you is very costly too.
Sure.
So if you're going to give the medication, okay, patient decides they want the medication, but isn't it also your responsibility to talk about the side effects and what supplements you may need to take, like coenzyme Q10, because what happens if your CoQ10 gets depleted or your minerals get depleted?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be better to prevent it by getting on the CoQ10 before it was depleted rather than to have to catch up and replace it after the levels have been depleted.
But even if you're on the statins, just to know that maybe this is something, or certainly this is something that you should be adding.
It would definitely be worth asking about if anyone is taking one of those statins, which include, you know, the drugs like Crestor and Lipitor and Zocor and Mevacor and Pravacol. If somebody is taking one of those, they might inquire with their doctor if they should be on a CoQ10 supplement or perhaps checking their levels of CoQ10.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, if you put somebody on a statin, how often are you checking their levels?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. You can now order a blood test and find out how the levels of CoQ10 are, and we do that commonly, and we find oftentimes that they are lower, let's say in lower end of the normal range, and they usually respond to supplements.
When you mentioned about some people taking all of these medications, and as I said about Lorraine Bracco's parents, that got my attention because I remember, I don't know how many years ago, reading in the Wall Street Journal a story about a woman who they thought was on her way out. And then a relative came in to say goodbye to her, and she saw all the different medications on the dresser, and the light bulb went off. Could it be possible? A lot of interactions between all these medications. So they began to slowly cut back and get her off some of them. And she came around.
Yeah.
She came around. It was almost like she was out of it. And it was from all the interactions of the medications.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it happens much more commonly than you would expect, believe it or not.
So when somebody you see that somebody you love or yourself are on it, so you're saying, talk to your doctor about, okay, am I taking too much or can I take a little bit less? Or which are the ones that I really need? And
sure.
What are the interactions?
I mean, one good way to think about it is if somebody is going in for a checkup and their doctor's prescribing a new medication that they're going to have to continue on, you know, one question worth asking is, well, which medication can I stop now that I'm starting this new one? Because that should be the thought process. And as if I'm starting one, I better think about which one I can stop.
But some people are very, well, it's a quick fix. I remember talking to someone who said he and his wife had the same cholesterol levels. She decided diet, nutrition, exercise. She brought her cholesterol levels down to normal. He said, I couldn't be bothered with that, so I'm just taking the medication. I mean, yeah. That's an individual thing.
Sure,
I mean, it's not one size fits all. I mean, whatever's going to work for you, but certainly.
That's somebody's personality, sure.
Yeah. It's just like in talking about diet. I mean, I've always said there are the group of people out there. You can tell somebody that the white pasty stuff and all the sugar and all the processed foods aren't great for you, but it tastes good. So it's like, don't talk to me. I'm going to continue with it. There are those people who already have gotten the message and they're not doing a lot of that. And then there are those people listening right now going, you know what? I didn't realize maybe I am overdoing it, you know, on unhealthy fats and, you know, sugar and processed foods. And it's because it's quick and easy and convenient and tasty or whatever. But as a doctor, when do you have that heart-to-heart talk with someone because everything they're doing is they're a heart attack, a stroke, diabetes waiting to happen?
Yeah, I mean, ideally that's an ongoing conversation, but you're right, and that is if I'm having that talk with somebody and they say, listen, doc, you know, I've never eaten great and I've never taken care of myself and I doubt I'm going to do it. It's just not likely that all of a sudden I'm going to start to, you know, eat right and lose weight and take care of myself. Well, fine. Then I know how to prescribe. That's fine if people won't. But my preference is if they say, you know, you're right, I could do better and make some changes in my diet and make some changes in the way that I exercise and I could, you know, make some changes in the way that I'm living to improve on these. And then I say, great, you know, here's some easy things that we can do.
One of the things you mentioned earlier in terms of inflammation was sleep. And I remember a family member of mine saying one time, well, I have plenty of time to sleep when I die. And I said, no, sleep is important. So let's go back to that relationship between sleep and how it does affect inflammation and all of the other good benefits of good, healthy sleep.
It's tragic because so many people are walking around, you know, half asleep because they're not getting the sleep that they need every night. And it's not necessarily 8 hours. It's really more about good quality sleep. And, you know, better sleepers might be able to get that in 6 or 7 hours. You know, people that aren't so good at sleeping might need 8 or 9 hours to get the quality that they need. And so it's hard to tell people you need 7.5 or 8 hours, but I'd say it's endemic right now, or epidemic, that people are not getting the sleep that they need. And they've learned that just sleep deprivation raises the level of inflammation. It's one of the stresses on the immune system, and it's one of the reasons why sleep deprivation has been linked with so many of these illnesses.
So if you don't get the certain amount of sleep, you're increasing your risk for certain diseases, and you're increasing your inflammation, which then contributes to increasing the risk of the diseases.
That's right. And so somebody that's chronically sleep deprived, you know, we have a pretty good prediction that they're not going to do well. You know, as time goes on, if that sleep deprivation continues, it's really going to lead to health issues. You know, the biggest people, the people at biggest risk are the shift workers. You know, if you're working a night shift, I used to do it in the emergency room where you'd work, you know, 3 day shifts, then you'd have 2 days off, and you come in and work three night shifts. And it was hard because you were always feeling tired. And, you know, my level of inflammation was running high because of the night shift work. And, you know, it was hard to get proper amounts of sleep when you come home at 7 in the morning and try to sleep for 7 or 8 hours.
The crazy part is, Mark, doctors are supposed to be telling everybody else how to be healthy and well, and yet the shift kind of thing is not good for the doctor's health and well-being. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. And not only that, it's not good for the patients either, because if you're sleep-deprived, you're not firing on all cylinders. And let me tell you, if somebody comes in at 3:30 in the morning, you know, you don't want to be my patient.
Right.
You know, if it's 9 in the morning, fine. But at 3:30 in the morning, you know I'm going to be feeling sleep deprived.
Well, I feel like if I'm sleep deprived, I mean, I'm talking for a living here. You know, what can I do? I'll bore somebody to death. But you're a doctor. If you're an airline pilot, if you're an engineer, a conductor, you know, on a train, I mean, you have other people's lives. That can be incredibly dangerous.
Sure.
They also say today that teenagers are sleep deprived because their bodies, they don't want to go to sleep till 11 o'clock. But a lot of schools are starting too early, and the American Pediatric Association and other government
agencies.
I couldn't agree more.
It's crazy for schools to start at 7:30 or 8 in the morning, especially for teens, because teens have a different body clock. You know, the teen's body clock works at a different pace. You know, teenagers are the champion sleepers, and the best sleep that they get is the early morning sleep. That's sleep between, let's say, 6 and 8 a.m., and we're depriving them of that because they got to get up at 6 or 6:30 now to go to school and be there for 7:30. And it's crazy that we're asking these teens and preteens to be at school at 8 o'clock. It's just not the right time. What we should do is make school 9 to 5, allow these preteens to sleep in until 8 or 8:30 and get breakfast before they come in. And then at the end of the day, let's put some physical activity into the day. Let's have a sports program, or, you know, hopscotch or jump rope or whatever it is, so that kids are moving during the day. Let's build that into their day so that they have, first, better sleep in the morning and better fitness and exercise in the afternoon.
So, but you say kids are naturally built to be champion sleepers if they didn't have this kind of schedule when they go to school.
Exactly. We're disrupting their natural hormonal schedule of sleep. We're interrupting it, and that's causing problems.
Wow. So, but the schools are continuing. I mean, they're continuing to start at 7, 7:30. It doesn't matter the recommendations, government recommendations, American Pediatric Association recommendations. How do you get a kid to go to bed earlier if their body is saying, I'm not going to fall asleep before 11?
A tough thing, especially when, you know, if you're a parent, you realize that, you know, the amount of control you have over a teenager is pretty limited. You know?
I think also for most people, it is not just the amount of sleep. It's about waking up in the middle of the night and when the brain is going. I know when I go to sleep, that's my time for problem solving. It's my I need to, you know, be creative. I need to be thinking about things. And then I realize I'm going at 100 miles per hour and I'm supposed to be going to sleep now. I need to quiet my brain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, when you've got an active, you know, sharp brain like yours, it wants to work. And you wake it up at 3 in the morning, it wants to do what it does, and that is get working on stuff. And, you know, my advice is don't let it. You know, got to distract it. Pick up a book and read a little bit until you're sleepy again, and then go back to sleep.
So what else do you do for yourself, Mark Lafonis, to get a good night's sleep?
Oh, boy, I wish I was a better sleeper, because I'm like you, Claire, and that is this mind of mine starts going, and I start thinking about a million and one things, and it's really sometimes hard. So I'll distract it. You know, I will read, or I'll get up and, you know, go downstairs and do something until I'm bored and tired, and, you know, I'll go back to bed. Sometimes that could be a half-hour gap in my sleeping through the night, but, you know, it's probably better to do that than just toss and turn in bed for an hour before I can fall back asleep.
Well, a good night's sleep is definitely good for you, but I've got to stop being at the computer about an hour before I go to sleep, Mark.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the computer, for one, has that bright light shining in your eyes, and that shuts off your melatonin production, so your brain isn't really sure what time of day it is. And not only that, look at what you're watching. You're probably watching the news or reading something that you don't want to see right before bed.
I'm always talking back to the news. But
yeah.
Mark, it is so great talking with you. There's so much more to say. Are you game for coming back for part two of our conversation?
Of course, Claire.
Okay. You've given us so much food for thought, and of course, perfectly healthy food. I mean, I remember what you said about the color of the rainbow and good thoughts. Things that make you smile and laugh are also good for you. So in part two of our conversation, we'll continue to learn more about inflammation, the role it plays in every major disease, and what you can do ideally to prevent it. Just a reminder to check us out at goodforyounetwork.com. What are you doing now that is good for your own well-being? And what are you doing now that's contributing to the well-being of others? Share your stories with us. And you can tweet us at GoodForYouNet. Follow us on Facebook at GoodForYouNetwork. And if you have questions relating to any aspect of well-being or ideas for the shows, why not email me at claire@goodforyounetwork.com. And this reminder, I believe, be the CEO of your own well-being. Take charge of your most important assets. It's the best investment you can possibly make. Thanks for joining us. I'm Claire Carter, and this is Good For You Radio.